You knew eventually the economics of this would be worked out in some form or fashion. No one wanted to see 2020 go by and there not be football. I mean, this is a huge, huge undertaking, Hannah. I think that cannot be understated. The amount of, you know, time and energy that's going into trying to have a football season in these kind of conditions is tremendous. And what they're pulling off is nothing short of a miracle.
That's ESPN's Lewis Riddick Jr., learning live on SportsCenter that the NFL and its players had agreed on a plan for the 2020 season, then expressing how hard it'll be to pull that plan off. The deal came together just in the nick of time, with teams reporting to training camp this week. Today, Dan Graziano joins the show to break down the details of that plan and which teams might benefit, then explains how they're going to define contact in a full contact sport. I'm Ina Kimes. It's Monday, July 27th. This is ESPN Daily.
Hi, Mina. How you doing?
You tell me, because my Seattle Seahawks just pulled off a very large trade, which I do want to talk to you about, them trading for Jamal Adams. But it makes me nervous about football returning because I want to see it happen, and I'm worried it still might not happen.
Yeah, I think you're on the right track. There's no way to get to 100% confidence about anything, and I don't think there will be all year.
Dan Graziano is an NFL insider for ESPN. He has been reading a lot of documents about health and safety lately.
I mean, they could get a month into the season and have to shut things down. So all of that kind of hangs over this, as it does with these other sports, and they all acknowledge that plans might have to change because of things that aren't in their control.
Well, let's talk about that plan. We'll talk about the Adams trade and some other on-the-field storylines later. But I want to discuss with you this agreement that the NFL and the NFLPA came to late last week, approving a deal to start the season. What did they work out?
Well, lots. I mean, first of all, they worked out the testing procedure in terms of how that's going to work out when they get to training camp. They worked out how training camp is going to work in terms of ramping up. It's not going to be any kind of on-field work, really, for the first 18 days. And padded practices have to wait till August 17th at the earliest, 14th for the Texans and Chiefs because they play earlier. They worked out what happens if a player wants to opt out, either for medical reasons or just because he doesn't feel comfortable with the situation. They worked out future impact on the salary cap of potential revenue loss this year. You know, they set a floor for next year, so the lowest the cap can go next year is $175 million per team, no matter what happens this year. And the revenue losses are more significant than that, they're going to spread the hits out over future years.
About the cap, it's notable that they set a floor, because even if, Dan, they play out this entire season, they're still going to lose a lot of money, right?
Yes, because the best case scenario is really to play the whole season and not have full stadium. There are going to be some places where they can't have any fans in the stadiums all year. There are going to be some places where they can have a few, and that might fluctuate as the year goes along. So the estimates we've seen indicate that if they had to play the whole year, like if they played the whole season and no fans were in the stands, the league would lose about 20 to 25% of its annual revenue. So figure if it's a $16 billion annual revenue, you're looking at $3, $4 billion. I mean, the salary cap is tied to revenue, but they came to a compromise. And the floor for next year was a really important point, because now they can budget knowing the worst case scenario.
So, Dan, while we think of these teams making most of their money off of TV, which is true, they also, as you laid out, get a lot from gate receipts. Are we going to see fans at some of these games?
Yes, there could be a situation where there are stadiums where no fans are allowed and other stadiums where some fans are allowed. The first instinct a lot of people have had is, well, is that fair? And it may be that the answer is no, but I think the answer may be no to a lot of is that fair questions this year, and people are going to have to get used to it. You know, you look at it, it's a revenue sharing league. So if Denver could fill 20% of a stadium and the Giants and Jets can't, everyone still benefits, right? Because the revenue that Denver's generating from that ends up getting shared to a certain extent around the league. So if they can put fans in the stands safely, you're not going to hear a lot of pushback from teams that can't. So it's going to be yet another one of the things that's just going to be figured out as they go along.
Dan, obviously the money was a big point of contention for the players, but so were some of the health and safety protocols. In fact, before they came to this agreement, we saw this campaign amongst the stars online saying they wanted to play, but they weren't happy with the testing regimen and guidelines. How did that get resolved?
They were talking about the ramp-up period in training camp. There was a group of medical professionals that they and the league charged with present us the best possible training camp plan. And what they came back with was 21 days of just strength and conditioning, followed by 10 days of non-padded practices, followed by 14 days where you could have pads on. So the players said, let's just adopt this. This is what the medical people said. Let's just do it. And the coaches and GMs, and then by extension, some of the owners thought that was going to make it even more difficult to get everybody ready. When the players all started tweeting that, I think a couple of them said the NFL is not following its own medical advice. And that's what they were talking about. So the way it got resolved is the owners came toward them significantly on that. I think at this point, the first 18 days of camp are going to be just strength and conditioning plus testing and physicals. And then they can start putting the pads on in the middle of August. So they just kind of compromised on that because guys are concerned. I mean, J.C. Treader, the Browns center, who's the president of the NFLPA, was saying last week, he said, it's not like the 2011 lockout year, because that year you could go to a private gym and work out. Yeah, I mean, like you could get in shape. You could be in, now no one knows where anybody's been or what they've been able to do for the last several months when they would normally have been getting ready for the season. So there's some concern among players that people are going to show up out of shape and are going to need more time than usual to get into shape. So that was where that negotiation kind of broke down.
The players also wanted more frequent testing, which they got. How is that going to work?
The first day you get to camp, your report day, you get tested, you go home, you don't go in the building. You sit home for 2 days, you go back on day four, you get tested again. If both of those tests come back negative, then on day five, you can show up and get your physical, get your, you know, equipment fitting done. Starting on that day five, you're tested every day for 2 weeks. And if after that 2 week period, a team's positive test rate is below 5%, then they go to every other day testing.
You mentioned that the NFL is looking to baseball, which is sort of the closest analog for how they're going to pull this off. Dan, hours before the opener, news broke that National star Juan Soto had tested positive. They still played. I guess the closest comparison would be like if before an NFL game, I don't know, Lamar Jackson tested positive. What would happen in that scenario for a football team?
Well, he would not be able to play. And there's a contact tracing operation set up with every team. So they would be able to identify everyone he's been in contact with when he's at the team facility, when he was practicing in the previous week's game. But you'll be able to tell he spent 15 minutes within 6 feet of these three people. So these three people now have to be tested and possibly quarantined, depending on, you know, whether they're showing symptoms, et cetera. So you're right. The Juan Soto thing, which happened on Thursday, right, which was the day before all these NFL agreements were announced. So talking to people on Friday, they were watching it closely. And it's not a question of Soto testing positive. It's a question of what results were after that. The entire Nationals team was tested, right? So how many of them came back positive? If that came back as some sort of outbreak, some sort of significant widespread positive test rate among the Nationals, that's cause for panic. In your hypothetical, Lamar Jackson tests positive. Well, we got to figure out who's been around him, who's been in close contact with him. The rules define close contact. There are several different categories that rise to the level of close contact. And they figure out who else needs to be quarantined. They're going to have, I don't want to say expanded rosters, probably expanded practice squads. So they'll be able to take somebody off of that and replace him for that week or any week he might have to miss. And there'll be a COVID-specific injured reserve list that he can go on and come off after a certain amount of time. It's just going to be a weird year, Mina. I mean, like, teams are just going to have to find a way to roll with that. Or the alternative, of course, is to not play at all. And that's what they're trying to avoid.
So it makes sense. And I believe that the contact tracing would work because we do it on the field now, Dan, chipping players to analyze them. However, there's a lot more contact in football, right? I mean, yeah. I just thinking about the Lamar Jackson example, it strikes me that you'd have a lot of players coming into close contact with him on the field. And I wonder if that would count in the same way and preclude them from playing too.
When you look at close contact as it's defined in these NFL standards, it's interesting that the rest of us can kind of learn about. One of them is within 6 feet of the person for at least 10 minutes.
Oh.
So they're trying to figure out how the stuff is transmitted, and they're basing this all on medical advice. They're not making this up. So there are standards that it rises to. And yes, if someone was in close contact with them, they would have to be checked and again, possibly quarantined. But yeah, football, I mean, it sounds crazy like to play football, right? Like, it's like, how can you have a game where they're literally breathing in each other's faces on every play when that's how the virus is transmitted? So they're trying to figure out the best way. You've seen the pictures, I'm sure, of these face shields, the Oakley face shields that they want them to wear. My understanding is they're not going to be mandatory, but they're going to be strongly encouraged. A lot of the players don't like it because they're worried about how it affects their field of vision and their breathing. But if they're able to test them out in camp and use them, the league believes that it'll reduce the chances of spread. So it's going to be toe in the water, right? Like, if this works, great, we'll keep doing it. If it doesn't work, we're going to have to adjust.
Yeah, it's fascinating. So maybe a guy tackling Lamar Jackson once and then running away would be fine. But I got to think the Ravens center, Matt Skura, would probably be a guy you'd want to quarantine in that scenario.
Yeah, I mean, Treader, you know, the NFLPA president who plays center, he was saying, he said, look, this is the most dangerous my job has ever been. Like, what I do. I mean, I look up into another guy's face, right? And we're breathing right at each other. Like, this is a concern. And his point was, we're not going to get to zero risk. It's going to be an exercise in risk mitigation. And if it gets to the point where the risk is too much to justify playing, then yeah, they could definitely shut it down.
So players are going to have 7 days to decide if they're going to play or not. There's going to be a clock running this week. And we've had an opt-out, Kansas City Chiefs guard Laurent Duvernay-Tardif, who is a medical school graduate who spent the offseason assisting as an orderly at a long-term care facility in Montreal, seeing the pandemic up close, cited his experience to announce that he was going to opt out. Do you anticipate there will be other players, and what is at stake for them?
Oh, there's no question there'll be other players, and we did see it in the other sports. You know, look, if you opt out before the season, you know, your contract will slide to next year, and they'll find a way to give you a stipend to help you through this year. And I guess in theory, the team could still cut you as they could have this year, but the stipend system, I think, will put some protections in place. There's different levels of compensation. If you're opting out because you're in a high-risk group, or you know your doctor has said that this is not what you should be doing, it's $350,000. If you're opting out by choice and you don't have an extenuating reason, it's $150,000. It's discouraging, obviously, I think, from the outside, that the first player to opt out, and that he did so hours after the agreement was in place, was the only player in the league who is a doctor. That is discouraging, but that's an outstanding story, and hopefully he's fine and comes back and resumes his career when this is all over. But other players, I'm sure, will opt out, and it will depend on whether they fall into a high-risk group, whether the league can define whether they're opting out for a medical reason or simply just because they're not comfortable, and that's going to affect what compensation they can get in terms of this season.
All right, after the break, let's talk about some of the stories we'll be following on the field as training camps get going.
When you're on a business trip, you know what completely goes off the rails? Your workout routine, especially when you book a hotel that doesn't have a gym. So what ends up happening is you do a few push-ups and sit-ups in your room, run around the block, or just skip it entirely. Lame. If you just stay at La Quinta by Wyndham, you'll discover there's a fully equipped fitness center at every location. Now you can wake up and power your buys and tries the right way or de-stress with some cardio. The choice is yours. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book direct at LQ.com.
Cool. All right, cool. Let's talk football.
Please.
So, Dan, last week you were more occupied with off-the-field NFL news, but on Saturday, A big piece of on-the-field news broke when it was reported that the Seattle Seahawks had traded a haul, including two first-round draft picks, to the New York Jets for Pro Bowl safety Jamal Adams. Now, in a way, this was completely surprising because Adams has made no secret of his desire to leave recently, despite having multiple years left on his rookie contract. But I think the size of the deal from Seattle's perspective was surprising in and of itself. Do you think this was a win for the New York Jets?
We had reached a point where it was hard to imagine Jamal Adams on the Jets this year. I mean, you can't really just have a star player that's just out there ripping the GM and coach all the time. And so I thought they were in a bad spot because it was going to be hard to get a lot for a guy that they sort of clearly had to move. But good for them. They did get a lot. If you had told me a week ago, oh, the Jets are going to get two first-round picks for this guy, I would have doubted you. I would have laughed because, he's not making it very easy for them to get that. Now I understood why the Jets, who said all along, we don't want to trade him, we don't want to trade him, were willing to do that. I mean, two first-round picks is nothing to sneeze at.
You mentioned there's uncertainty about the cap right after this year, even though there is a floor. It strikes me that there might also be uncertainty about the value of draft picks, given that there might not be college football, or at least a very different college football season. What are you hearing about how teams perceive that?
Well, it's going to be the toughest draft ever to evaluate. You're going to have to rely on 2019 tape for a lot of the big guys. Let's say they play in the spring. If you're a first round pick or second round, you're not going to want to play that close to the draft. We don't know how games are going to be able to be scouted at any level. There's no preseason. There's no public practices. How are you going to scout? It's going to come down to how much you trust your evaluators, what you can learn about guys in terms of whatever in-person interaction you can have with them, be it in person or via Zoom or phone calls, whatever. But I think it's going to be a very weird draft. If you're Seattle Seahawks, you just traded your first round pick, which they're accustomed to being, you know, somewhere in the mid-20s, right? For a guy that you can feel pretty confident is better player than anybody you would get at that pick next year. So that's their perspective on it. And they feel is a 24-year-old star safety that can, you know, can be everything we need him to be on defense. That's more of a sure thing than my draft pick would have been. So that's one example of how this breaks down. And from the Jets' standpoint, the more picks, the better in a draft where you're really not sure what you're going to get.
So unlike college football, the NFL is definitely happening, or as we discussed, trying to happen,
right,
aiming to get started. But the offseason is still very weird. As part of the agreement, preseason was canceled. How is that going to affect how teams approach the beginning of this season, not having their usual offseason regimen?
Roster decisions are going to be made with less evidence than usual, right? Like, you're not going to be able to say, oh, we saw him out there in the game. We saw him when the lights went on and he looked like this. You're going to start with smaller rosters. Most teams are probably going to have 80 guys at camp. When it comes time to set your roster, you're going to probably have to lean more on, hey, this guy's got some experience. It may not be a year where the back of the roster undrafted rookie comes out of nowhere to make the team, because you may say, look, I don't know what I have here. I do know what I have in this 5-year veteran that we brought into camp for very little money. And I think we need to go with more of a sure thing. Now, the one thing you will see is, again, either bigger rosters or expanded practice squads. So when you make a cut at the end of August, beginning of September, you may be in a position where you don't have to necessarily lose the guy and you have easier access to him. Because if there are COVID specific rules regarding practice squads that allow you to take guys on and off without sending them through waivers, that pretty much extends the size of your roster. So as I said earlier, these documents are leaking out and trickling out in terms of the specifics of how it's all going to work. You're not going to be able to bend the virus to football. You're going to have to bend football to the virus. And that's, everything's got to change, and probably more things than we even realize at this point.
So for the most part, the lack of preseason will, as you said, affect, you know, players that the end of the roster, special teams guys, undrafted guys. But there are some teams, Dan, with unanswered questions at key positions, like, for example, Chicago, right? We might have seen Nick Foles and Mitch Trubisky have a quarterback competition in the preseason, That won't happen now. So how do you see that playing out?
I think one of the important things to realize about the Nick Foles acquisition for the Bears is that part of the motivation for that was the experience that several members of the Bears offensive coaching staff have with Foles in past years. And when they looked at, we need to bring in a veteran to push Trubisky or play if he can't get it done, there were other options, but they went with Foles because he was a known quantity. And I think you saw a lot of that in March when free agency, because coaches are looking, saying, I'm not going to have as much time as usual to get guys to learn my system. So in the case of Foles, you know, rather than go for Teddy Bridgewater or Cam Newton or someone like that, you know, Foles was a guy that the Bears coaching staff looked at and said, we can bring him in and we have something like a known quantity here because of our experience with him in the past. I think they'll give Trubisky every chance, but they're in a tight window. And if he starts looking like a guy who shows the inconsistency of past years, then they're not going to have a problem leaning toward Foles just because he's new.
What about New England? Because when they signed Cam Newton, there was this assumption, okay, he's going to win the job in preseason. But again, there's no preseason, so there's not a traditional competition.
I think the key thing with Cam is the health, right? The reason he sat there for so long without interest was because he's coming off the foot injury that cost him basically the whole season. No one knows what a Cam Newton who can't run looks like, so you don't know what to sign him for. So I think with him, it'll be a matter of getting him on the field, see how he's moving around, rather than just, you know, kind of bringing him up to speed in terms of the system. I think Josh McDaniel's smart enough offensive coordinator to figure out what he has and work with it. So I think the expectation is if Cam shows up and seems healthy after all the health issues he's had the last couple of years, he probably emerges quickly as the starter. And if he doesn't, the contract doesn't even require him to make the team.
So all of this is, of course, predicated on not only the season beginning, Dan, but the season continuing. We talked about all of the things that had to come together to get this started. What would it take to shut the whole thing down?
That is the big question. And that's the question that no one has an answer for. The virus was suddenly spreading throughout the league and they couldn't keep it under control with their testing and their contact tracing procedures. Now, is there a specific number of cases or number of, you know, no, because they don't really know how it's all going to look. There's also external factors. I mean, if we get into a situation like we were in March and April in the country where cities and states are issuing stay-at-home orders, I mean, you know, that could affect all these sports and prevent games from being played. So either internally, when they feel like the testing and tracing doesn't work to control it, or externally, when governors and mayors are saying, hey, everybody's got to stay home again.
All right. I want to end on a positive note.
Please.
Our Stefania Bell reported just over the weekend that Alex Smith, whose story, you know, listeners heard on this very podcast, has been cleared for full football activity, which, again, if you listen to the podcast or saw the E60 or have seen what happened to Alex Smith, is unbelievable. What does that mean, Dan?
Yeah, I was covering the game like that. I was there the day it happened to him. And I remember hearing all the stuff about the, you know, he had to have trauma surgeons do the surgery because it was so urgent. I mean, like, it's, the idea that he could ever play again is astounding. The nuts and bolts of it, look, he's cleared by his doctors. The team's doctors are going to have to clear him if he's going to be allowed to practice and play for them. So that's another hurdle he would have to clear. But, you know, it's an amazing story. He's obviously a guy that is of significant value to that team no matter what. You hear a lot of stuff about last year and how he worked and helped with Dwayne Haskins. And I think there's a belief that he'll be around regardless. But the idea that he could go to camp and compete for the job is mind-boggling and would be probably the greatest comeback story of the league, not only this year, but in recent memory. I think that's, at this point, we just say that's pretty cool and let's hope for the best for him regardless of what it is and just keep following the story, which Stefania is obviously doing it better than anybody.
Thanks so much, Dan.
My pleasure.
Coming up, as some sports weigh the details of a return, the National Women's Soccer League crowned a champion.
Now let's talk about the play of the week. The pressure to follow up Hypnotic and Cognac weighing heavy on the team. Hypnotic was in the cup, blue, and ready for the play. And boom, Añejo Tequila came in with a smooth assist to Hypnotic's tropical fruit finish. Shaken, strained, poured, it was green and good. The playmaking splash shifted the tempo, another great cocktail from the Hypnotic team. Every season is Hypnotic and tequila season. Hypnotic Liqueur, Bardstown, Kentucky, 17% alcohol by volume. Hypnotic reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely.
Here's another story I want you to know. In late June, the National Women's Soccer League became the first pro sports league to return to play in the United States. And on Sunday, they concluded their tournament. The victors? The Houston Dash, who beat the Chicago Red Stars 2-0 in the Challenge Cup final. The Dash won on the back of goals from midfielder Sophie Schmidt, who scored the first goal on a penalty kick 5 minutes into the match.
Schmidt got it! Houston up one!
And Shea Groom, who sealed the win with the second goal in the 90th minute, beating Red Stars goalie Alyssa Nayer, who had come far off the line.
Minutes of stoppage time, and Shea Groom could say good night! Houston, add some insurance!
Houston Dash captain Rachel Daly was awarded the tournament's MVP and the Golden Boot thanks to an assist on Groom's goal. Beyond the result, this is a massive deal for a couple of reasons. Before this year, the team, which was created in 2014, had never even made the playoffs. And two, it's a positive sign for sports, or at least sports handled with care. Throughout the month-long tournament, which was played outside of Salt Lake City, the players in the quote-unquote bubble took over 2,000 coronavirus tests with no positives. Now, the league hopes to continue playing in their respective home markets in August. Fingers crossed for a similarly exciting and safe result. I'm Mina Kimes, and this has been ESPN Daily. I'll talk to you tomorrow.